Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a really interesting 2013 case from Oklahoma, Logan v. State.
Yes, this one's key.
If you've ever wondered, you know, what happens after a conviction and maybe a failed appeal, especially if you feel like the lawyer missed something big, well, this deep dive is for you.
That's right. We're going to kind of dissect this case to understand how courts deal with these claims. Claims that an appellate attorney, the one handling the appeal, wasn't effective, particularly when the arguments maybe weren't even made in the first appeal.
So our mission today is really to pull out the core ideas from Logan v. State, looking at how procedural rules and these ineffective assistance claims interact, and what it means practically.
Exactly. What does it mean for navigating post-conviction stuff?
Okay, so let's start with Charles Lee Logan. He was convicted of two robberies, robbery with a firearm and robbery in the first degree.
And the sentence was heavy. Life plus 40 years.
Yeah. His direct appeal failed. So then he applied for post-conviction relief, which is, you know, a way to challenge a conviction after those initial appeals are done.
And his main argument in that post-conviction application was that his appellate lawyer messed up, that they were ineffective because they didn't raise certain issues.
Right. And that gets us to the big question. If arguments weren't made on direct appeal, are they just gone forever? Waived?
Can you bring them back? If the reason they were missed was because the appellate lawyer dropped the ball, that's the nub of it.
And what's really interesting here is that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, the OCCA, they were actually a bit divided on this, which makes their decision super insightful for us.
Definitely. Adds another layer.
Okay, so before we get too deep into Logan's specific arguments, let's just quickly unpack the legal background. We need to understand the Strickland standard and this idea of procedural waiver.
Absolutely essential. Yeah. So Strickland v. Washington, that's the big Supreme Court case for any ineffective assistance claim, trial, or appeal. It sets up a two-part test.
Two parts, right.
First, you got to show the lawyer's performance was deficient, fell below like an objective standard of reasonableness, what a confident lawyer would have done.
Okay, deficient performance. What's the second part?
Second part is prejudice. You have to show that because of the lawyer's bad performance, there's a reasonable probability the result would have been different, like the outcome of the trial or the appeal.
Got it. Deficient performance and prejudice. Now, how does that Strickland standard apply specifically to appellate lawyers? Because their job's different, right? They're not presenting evidence in the same way.
That's a key distinction. For appellate counsel, deficient performance usually means they unreasonably fail to raise a non-frivolous issue, an argument that had some merit.
Not just any argument, though.
No, not just any argument. Often, courts look for what they sometimes call a dead bang winner. You know, an issue that was so obviously strong, so likely to win, that any reasonably competent appellate lawyer would spot it and raise it.
A dead bang winner. Mm. Okay, so it's about missing something really clear.
Exactly. Appellate lawyers make strategic choices. Sure, they have to decide what to focus on. But just completely missing a slam dunk argument, that could be seen as deficient performance.
Right. Not second guessing strategy, but identifying a clear miss. Okay, now let's talk about Oklahoma's procedural waiver rule. What's that about?
Okay, so Oklahoma, like most places, has rules to make sure litigation eventually ends. Finality, right? Their rule, it's in the statutes, Title 22, Section 1086, basically says if you don't raise an issue in your direct appeal, you generally lose the chance to raise it later in post-conviction.
So you kind of get one shot on direct appeal.
That's the general idea. It creates a procedural bar. Prevents people from just bringing up new stuff endlessly.
Okay, that seems like a big hurdle then. So how did Logan try to get around that bar?
This is where the exception comes in, that procedural bar. It's not absolute. A key exception is if the reason the claims weren't raised on direct appeal was because the appellate lawyer was ineffective.
Ah, okay, so that connects back to Strickland.
Exactly. So Logan argued, hey, my appellate lawyer was ineffective because they didn't challenge the search or the eyewitness ID or even stuff my trial lawyer did wrong. By framing it that way, he was trying to use the ineffective assistance claim as a gateway, basically.
A gateway to get the court to look at those underlying issues, even though they weren't in the first appeal. Makes sense. He's saying it wasn't my fault these weren't raised. It was my lawyer's.
Precisely. So you should look at them now.
Okay, so let's get into what the OCCA actually decided. They upheld the denial of relief, right? Logan didn't win overall.
Correct. He didn't get the relief he wanted. But, and this is crucial, the judges on the appellate court didn't all agree on why the district court denied it, or rather, how they got there. And that disagreement is really instructive.
Let's start with the majority opinion. Judge Smith wrote that one.
Yes, Judge Smith for the majority. they found that the district court actually made a mistake. The lower court hadn't properly looked at the merit of the arguments Logan said his lawyer missed.
So the district court just said waived and stopped.
Pretty much. The OCCA majority said you can't just do that. You have to first figure out if the failure to raise those issues was ineffective assistance under Strickland. Both prongs.
So what did the majority want the district court to do instead?
They sent it back, remanded it, mm-hmm. with specific instructions. The district court needed to do a proper Strickland analysis focused on the appellate lawyer.
And what were the key questions for the district court?
Two main things. First, were those issues the lawyer didn't raise plainly meritorious? Like, were they actually strong arguments?
Yeah.
And second, if they had been raised, is there a reasonable probability the appeals outcome would have changed?
Okay, so dig into the substance. Got it. Now, what about Judge Lumpkin's opinion? He concurred in part, but dissented in part.
Right. Judge Lumpkin agreed Logan shouldn't get relief, but he strongly disagreed with sending it back for more analysis. He thought Logan's claims in the post-conviction filing were just too vague, not enough specifics.
Too vague. So Logan hadn't done enough to even justify that deeper look.
That was Judge Lumpkin's view. He really stressed that the petitioner, the person filing for post-conviction relief, has the burden. They need to show clearly that the omitted issues weren't just like okay arguments, but were clearly stronger than the ones the lawyer did raise.
Ah, clearly stronger. That's a high bar, too.
Definitely. And Judge Lumpkin was concerned. He felt remanding in this situation kind of undermines the whole point of waiver and procedural bars. It risks opening the floodgates, maybe.
So the core disagreement seems to be about how much a court should dig into these unraised issues when someone claims ineffective appellate counsel. Is that fair?
I think that's exactly right. The majority wanted a deeper look to ensure Strickland was properly applied, making sure a potentially valid claim wasn't just procedurally blocked. The dissent worried about weakening procedural rules without a strong initial showing from the petitioner. It's a tension between ensuring fairness and maintaining finality.
Okay, we've unpacked the court's reasoning and the split. Let's try to pull out some key takeaways, especially for law students listening. What are the big lessons here?
Okay, first big one. Procedural waiver is real. It's significant, but it's not absolute. Ineffective assistance of appellate counsel can be a pathway to review those waived issues.
But crucially, only if you meet that tough Strickland standard, right? It's not automatic.
Not at all.
Oh.
And that brings us to maybe a helpful way to think about these omitted issues. Let's call it the three tiers.
Okay, three tiers. What's the first?
Tier one, those dead bang winners we talked about.
Hmm.
Plainly meritorious claims. If an appellate lawyer misses something that was obviously a winning argument, think like a totally warrantless search with zero justification, and the lawyer just doesn't raise it, that omission is very likely ineffective assistance.
That seems clear enough. If you miss an obvious winner, that's bad lawyering.
Right. But even then, remember, courts presume lawyers are competent. So you really have to show it was a clear error, not just a debatable call.
Okay, so that's tier one, the obvious winners. What's tier two?
Tier two, meritless claims. If the issue the lawyer didn't raise was just bad, no legal basis, then omitting it can't be prejudicial under Strickland. Even if you argue they should have raised it, which is doubtful if it's meritless, you wouldn't have changed the outcome anyway.
No harm, no foul, basically. If the argument was a loser anyway, omitting it doesn't hurt the client's case in the Strickland sense.
Exactly. No prejudice, no successful claim.
All right, so what's the third tier? This must be the tricky one.
This is the gray area. Claims that have some merit, but they aren't slam dunks. They aren't dead bang winners.
Mm.
These are the toughest ones, and Logan really highlights this. Here, courts have to do a really detailed case-specific analysis.
How do they analyze that gray area?
They have to weigh things. How strong was the omitted argument really? How did it compare to the arguments the lawyer did make? What was the overall strategy? Was it unreasonable for the lawyer making strategic choices to leave that particular argument out? It's complex.
So that's where the lawyer's judgment really comes under scrutiny.
For sure. And this leads to another key point from Logan, echoing Judge Lumpkin's concerns. Procedural rigor matters in post-conviction. It's not just a do-over for the direct appeal.
Right. You can't just say, my lawyer missed stuff.
No. The petitioner has a real burden. They need to be specific. Show how the omitted issues meet both parts of Strickland. Deficient performance and prejudice. You need detailed arguments supported by facts and law.
Okay. Be precise, be thorough, makes sense. Anything else?
Yeah, I think the final big takeaway is just how hard it is to win an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. Logan shows that, even with a remand, the bar is very high.
So for law students, the message is...
The direct appeal is critical. That's the main event.
Yeah.
Identifying and arguing the strongest points then is paramount. It's the best way to protect your client's rights because trying to fix things later via post-conviction is really, really tough.
Okay, let's wrap up our deep dive on Logan v. State. It's clear, waiver isn't absolute, but getting around it via ineffective assistance is a narrow and demanding path.
Definitely. We've seen that spectrum of the dead bang winners, the meritless claims, and that complex gray area in between. And we've really hammered home the strict requirements of Strickland.
Absolutely. And for law students listening, grasping Logan gives you really valuable insight into post-conviction work and how Strickland plays out specifically on appeal.
For sure. Which brings us to maybe a final thought for everyone listening to consider, given how hard it is to prove ineffective appellate counsel later on. What does that say about the ethical duties of appellate lawyers up front, when they're first reviewing a case, deciding what to argue on direct appeal?
How do they best protect their clients from the start?
Yeah. Knowing the hurdles down the road, how should that shape their strategy and diligence during that crucial direct appeal phase? Something definitely worth thinking about as you learn and eventually practice law.